During which time the work developed here in America and Canada, in New Zealand and Australia, in Africa, in Europe, and outposts began to form in such places as India, later in Hong Kong and Japan, and then in Colombia and Brazil and South America. So without question, the truth today is established in every continent upon the face of the globe, and remarkably has penetrated very strongly behind the Iron Curtain into Romania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and East Germany. I have heard reports, which I can't verify, that books have gone indeed into Russia as well, but I can't verify that. But I do know it's very well established in Romania and Czechoslovakia because Wolfgang Meyer, first of all, and Andreas in turn, have visited those countries and been with believers in those various lands. I might just remark too that the actual Seventh-day Adventist Church itself in those countries is a state church. And by state church I mean it's run by the government at according to government permissions. The members pay their tithe to the government just as they pay taxes, and the government uses that money to pay ministers of their own appointment to preach what the government says they can preach in those church organisations in Romania and Czechoslovakia and East Germany and so on. So when the Adventist people tell you that their churches are prospering in those countries, remember, it's under those conditions, not under true freedom. Now, our believers, of course, are totally separated from the state, and it's amazing how God protects our believers, even though they illegally worship from Sabbath to Sabbath. Now, coming back then to the point I was making in regard to true church organisation, in which we recognise Christ as being the only head of the church, that's a very serious Babylonian principle for men to rule over men in the place of God. That the illustration given by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 12 of a human body in which there's one head but many members was to be practically implemented amongst the people of God so that no man ever told any other man what to do. That each person refers to Jesus Christ and him alone. There are those, of course, who regard this as being the basis for disunity and confliction of effort and duplication of expenditure, and that of course is entirely true if there is no living connection between the head and the members. But if there's a living connection between the head and the members, then it is not possible for there to be disunity. Look at your own body, for instance, and you have many members, fingers, toes, hands, eyes, heart, stomach, and all the various organs of your body. And when there is a living connection between the head and each of your body members, then don't you find perfect coordination? The arms and the legs all move in correct rhythm. The heart does its work and so forth and so on throughout the entire body. And in a church organization where each member has a personal living connection with the divine head, Jesus Christ, there can only be perfect unity of effort, perfect coordination of all the resources of every member in the church. It is argued by some that the Seventh-day Adventist Church organization organized in 1863 because they'd become too big to remain any longer as a disorganized body. Now, first of all, they were not a disorganized body. Secondly, the church was much larger, numbering 50,000 members between August and October 1844 than it was in 1863 when they did organize. The real reason for the organization is laid out in Testimonies to Ministers, page 24. I'd like to read that statement and turn it in the opposite direction from which it is generally incorrectly used. Page 24 in the book Testimonies to Ministers, the first paragraph reads as follows, and this was written, by the way, in about 1903, I believe. I just can't get a date here quickly, but I'm sure it was 1903. And Sister White says, it is nearly 40 years since organization was introduced amongst us as a people. That takes us back to 1863. I was one of the number who had an experience in establishing it from the first. I know the difficulties that had to be met, the evils which it was designed to correct, and I watched its influence in connection with the growth of the cause. At an early stage in the work, God gave a special light upon this point, and this light, together with the lessons that experience has taught us, should be carefully considered. Now, what most folk read in this statement is the fact that Sister White herself led out in this church organizational structure in the year 1863. Therefore they conclude that this was entirely God's will for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. What is overlooked is this, They overlooked the little sentence which says, the evils which it was designed to correct. Now then, obviously these evils were present in 1863, but not present back in 1844, or 1840, or 1836, or 1833. In other words, for 30 solid years, the church was organized without this kind of organizational structure. But if those evils had been present 10 years before, or 20 years before, or 15 years before, then what would have been necessary? This kind of organization to correct those evils. Now, what were those evils? By 1863, as we learned earlier in this week, the Seventh-day Adventist Church had become Laodicean. They had been Laodicean for at least 4 years by that time. Now, do Laodiceans have a living connection with their head? They don't. Therefore, can the organizational system to which Paul makes reference in 1 Corinthians 12 operate when there is no living head to the organization? No hope. There is no way in which a Laodicean church can operate according to divine principles of organization. That's impossible because they don't have the living head. There's no gold, no white raiment, no eye salve, no connection with their Savior. Now, when you have a headless body, and the body still has some life in it, have you ever, back in your heathen days, been given the task of chopping the rooster's head off for Sunday dinner and let it go? Charges all over the yard, flapping its wings, falling and getting up again, and for a few minutes until life finally peters out completely. So it is possible to have a living, headless body, living in a certain sense of the word. And the Laodicean church, having become headless, then of course became threatened to become disorganized, to lose its coordination, and another head had to take the place of the living head, and this of course had to be human heads, that is, responsible human heads, to take the place of the divine head, even though of course very inadequately. Now, however, this was God's last resort, because before the church finally became headless altogether, the Lord tried very hard through the spirit of prophecy to bring them back into a working relationship with Him. And you only have to read the testimonies written between about 1856 or even earlier than that. No, I think 1856 they began, to 1859. Those chapters called Thy Brother's Keeper, The Rich Young Ruler, Young Sabbath Keepers, Worldly, I've forgotten how that one goes now. And then the first presentation of the Laodicean message, the Shaking Chapter. The second presentation of the Laodicean message to see that God tried with all his might and power to reconnect the head with the body. He tried very hard to do that. And if he'd done that, if he'd been successful in doing that, then there would have been no need for the organizational structure to come in, which did come in. But when he failed to do it, of course, then the evils began to present themselves, each man became his own head, or tended to become his own head, and anarchy and disunion and a lack of coordination began to manifest itself in the church body. And the Laodicean church would have fallen apart into a fragmented ruin if this organizational structure which was brought in 1863 was not introduced. Now, just like God's command to ancient Israel to take the sword, and just as God tried unceasingly to take the sword away from them again, so God has been working to bring his people back to the place where they no longer need that kind of organizational structure in which men rule over men in the place of God. Now, very obviously, of course, God's first task is to bring out a body of people who once again have a living connection with the living head. And once that has been established, what can we expect God to do about the old organization? Discard it, right? Discard it. And this movement, of course, being one in which spiritual connection with Jesus Christ is made the number one priority, the all-consuming priority. This organization, which we are most concerned about people having a living connection with their head, Jesus Christ, naturally, therefore, is one in which God has delivered us from that old organizational structure in which men rule over men in the place of God, where decisions are made by committees and boards of management and so forth. And in the same book, page 300, namely Testimonies to Ministers, there is a prophecy written of that day which has now arrived, when, once again, God alone should be the head of the work. I read now from page 300 in the book Testimonies to Ministers. Unless those can help in, blank, someplace not mentioned here, a dash is all we see, are aroused to a sense of their duty, they will not recognize the work of God when the loud cry of the third angel shall be heard. When light goes forth to lighten the earth, instead of coming up to the help of the Lord, they will want to bind about his work to meet their narrow ideas. Let me tell you that the Lord will work in this last work in a manner very much out of the common order of things and in a way which would be contrary to any human planning. So by the sure word of God, we are to know then that there will be no human planning involved at all in the final work. Who alone should be the plan maker? God through Jesus Christ. He and he alone will be the plan maker. And I really love that statement in Christ's topic lesson, which says that in the garment of righteousness, and God's work is God's righteousness too, there is not one thread of what? Human, not one thread of it. Now you think of a garment such as is referred to here, a long sleeve garment right down to your ankles, neck to ankle, and quite voluminous. It wasn't a skimpy garment, the garment of righteousness. And would you like to estimate how many single threads are in such a garment? It's probably hundreds of thousands of them. And not one of them, not one tiny thread, maybe half an inch long, and as slender as a piece of cotton, is to be of human devising. That's a very all-exclusive picture, isn't it, of human devising? A totally exclusive picture. So this statement definitely presages a return once again to the original organizational structure under which William Miller operated, and to which the Protestant reformers turned as they came out of the Roman system of government. And there is that, can I borrow that Lesson of Reformation again? Do you have it handy? Lesson of Reformation? Don't worry. I'll just more or less mention the points. In the wonderful chapter called Reformation, Guidance of the Church by A.T. Jones in the book Lesson of Reformation, he makes the point that every time apostasy came in and the Church of God lost their living connection with the head, in came human election, human voting, and all those things. But every time that a new reformation was organized by God, and they shook off the old darkness and the old apostasy, they also shook off the human organizational structure and returned to a situation where God alone was the head. Now let me go a little further in this statement in Testaments Ministers, page 300. I'll read the sentence again before I go on. Let me tell you, and that means the Sister White's very emphatic. She said, I'm really going to let you know this. Let me tell you that the Lord will work in this last work in a manner very much out of the common order of things and in a way that will be contrary to any human planning. There will be those amongst us who will always want to control the work of God, to dictate even what movement shall be made. When the work goes forward under the direction of the angel who joins the third angel in the message to be given to the world, God will use ways and means for which it will be seen that he is taking the reins in his own hands. The workers will be surprised by the simple means that he will use to bring about and perfect his work of righteousness. Those who are counted good workers will need to draw nigh to God. They will need the divine touch. They will need to drink more deeply and continuously at the fountain of living water in order that they may discern God's work at every point. Workers may make mistakes, but you should give them a chance to correct their errors, give them an opportunity to learn caution by leaving the work in their hands. So then it becomes very clear that the organizational structure involving presidents, committees, boards of management, divisions, unions, conferences, churches, and so forth is an interim situation designed to keep the Laodicean church together long enough that it can fulfill its mission to preserve the theory of truth until God could bring out again a living movement. And that time, of course, has presently come. And as I said last night, the Lord taught us back in the early 1960s, 1966, mid-60s, I guess I should better say, what his kind of organizational structure was. And as I said before, I plan to learn my lessons only once. I don't have to go back and retrace my steps and learn them over and over again. And so it was that when in 1974, a man named Charlie Morgan, who was the uncle of the young man shot and killed by his mother-in-law, whose name was Ken Morgan, began to become a cause of concern for us because we saw him literally losing his Christian experience. The joy went out of his life. He began to ask questions that he ought not to be asking. He began to express doubts. At first he realized he was slipping and said so, but then it wasn't very long before he began to develop instead a kind of a Laodicean self-assurance. And then it became apparent that he was really losing his experience altogether. And the next thing he became concerned about the safety and security of the treasury and the movement and so forth. And he became more and more worried about this and began to travel extensively throughout Australia, campaigning for a return to a very strict control system of organisation. He wanted me brought under control of a committee, so I went where the committee said and did what the committee told me to do. The committee would take over the treasury and make sure the money was correctly spent and so forth and so on and so on. And I saw in this a betrayal of the very things he'd stood for and accepted just about 8 years before. Now, I followed my usual practice of not fighting against him. I didn't go to war over the situation. I simply left him to do what he felt he had to do and went about my work, leaving the problem of solving this thing entirely and completely in God's hands. I've come to learn, and I'd like to stress this point, that this movement is not mine, it's God's. And God is his defender. I remember, in his book, The Reformation in England, made the point that when Henry VIII named himself as the defender of the faith, in fact, I think it's still on English coins, and I think it's an English coin still, that the Queen is a defender of the faith, and D'Aubigné said that this was usurping God's position because God is a defender of the faith, not us. And so I made no attempt to counter the work of Charlie Moore. I just let him go amongst the believers and left him with the complete freedom to hear what he had to say. And he had a lot to say, believe me, about my character, amongst other things. You can always rely. One thing you can rely on every time, it never misses. When a person comes leveling accusation at another person, he is a servant of Satan. It doesn't matter how pious they may look, how dedicated they may seem to be, how hardworking, how high in your esteem they may previously have been held. When they start to level accusations, they have joined the band of him who is called the accuser of the brethren. And one thing that no Christian should ever do, or two things we should never do, is one, become a counter-accuser, and number two, spend time defending your good name. It might be very good anyway, but have a good about me, but don't defend it. I've always been greatly impressed by the statement in Volume 3 of the Testimonies where Sister White was given a vision. And in this vision, she saw the people of God advancing along under God's leadership, and behind them, following them, were a number of people that were hurling black balls after them. And she saw that if the children of God were to turn around and try and fend off these black balls, the result was that they would then find their clothing being marked and dirtied and besmirched by the balls, whereas they ignored them, even though the balls struck them, they fell to the ground, leaving no mark whatsoever. I'm just trying to find it, but I just didn't see it in the index to Volume 3, but it's in Volume 3 of the Testimony somewhere. If you look at black balls in the big three-volume index, you'll find it for sure. And And then she asked, what did this all mean? And Sister White was told by the angel that the black balls were the true and false stories told about the people of God. You know, God's folk do make mistakes. We do get ourselves into some tangles sometimes. And people looking on, of course, often form their own opinions of what may be a very innocent action upon our part. And consequently, the black balls were all these slanderous things said about them. And if the people of God tried to defend their good name and answer these charges, then they only made matters worse. The accusations stuck and their reputations were tarnished. But if they completely ignored the black balls and went about the work God had given them to do, then the stories fizzled out and had no evil effect upon the work of God in any sense whatsoever. It's a lesson well worth learning, believe me. And so when Charlie Morgan began to circulate around the field, I let him do it. I didn't make any attempt to follow after him to counter his work. I went on with what I had to do. I had my orders and I carried them out and left him completely in God's care. Now at this point, I'd like to, just a minute, I'll go ahead just a little bit further before I make that point. Now, my work, of course, involves some visitation around the field, which was not influenced by his activities. I just carried out as normal. And as usual, I planned to get into Grafton and visit the believers there and go on to Sydney and visit them and come home again. Went to Grafton and talked to the folk there with the usual, with a little batch of Bible studies and nice fellowship. And then on, I think it was probably Sunday morning and Monday morning after the weekend was over, I boarded a commercial flight to fly from Grafton to Sydney to spend the next several days with the believers down there. And this problem of Charlie Moore was somewhat on my mind, and I asked God for his answer to the problem. Because I have found that every time a crisis has overtaken this movement, God has given us a very beautiful answer to it, and the answer has exactly met our needs. I say exactly met our needs. And I happen to have with me a book I don't read very often, namely Acts of the Apostles. I'm not saying it's a bad book, it's an extremely good book, well worth a lot more reading than I give it, especially as we're facing our rerun of that history in the coming Loud Cry period. And I more or less opened the book at random. I wanted to do some spiritual reading on the plane. I wasn't thinking in terms of searching for an answer. When I opened at random at the chapter entitled Paul a Prisoner, beginning on page 400 of the book Acts of the Apostles, or is it 399? It's 399 to be more exact. Now, if you've read the Sabbath Rest book carefully, you'll remember there's a chapter in there entitled, what's it called again? But it does go through this chapter on Paul a Prisoner. What's that chapter called? Problems in the Early Church, it's called in the book God's Sabbath Rest. And assuming and hoping that you've all read the book carefully through at least once and hopefully several times, I won't detail this chapter as closely as I might, but I'll just run through it quickly and give the main high points to it. The chapter opens with Paul's last return from, I should mention, as I read this chapter through, I saw with tremendous clarity that we were actually reliving the experience to which Paul went back there in the early church. That the same things were happening as had happened back there, and I knew exactly what I must do as I read of the mistake that Paul himself made. I don't condemn Paul for one moment. If I'd been back in his shoes, I would have done the same thing, no doubt, especially if I had as great a heart of love and compassion as he had, which I certainly don't. But having seen what Paul did and the outcome of his sincere but mistaken course of action, I have no excuse for doing the same thing as he did, and therefore his story becomes of very great value to us in these latter days. Now the story back there, as you trace to this chapter, and I'll do it quite briefly, I think, this morning, is as follows. It begins with Paul's return to Jerusalem after his last missionary journey, where Paul found a spirit of coldness and inability to appreciate the spirit which motivated the self-sacrificing believers out in the Gentile mission field. And then Sister White goes back to trace the development of that spirit. And she begins then with that point of time when they had come out of the Jewish church. The cross is behind them. The ascension of Christ is behind them. The latter rain has fallen upon them, the latter rain, and the movement has become a well-defined structure. Now, there were, well, practically everyone in the movement had come out of the Jewish church organization. And we know the old story where we're warned that old habits strive for the mastery. And the only kind of church organization I'd ever known, ever experienced, or ever worked with was the Jewish church organization. And what kind of structure is that? Man over man in the place of God is papal through and through. So what was the natural tendency of these men to do or to introduce them to into the Christian church? The kind of organization which they knew. And so Sister White writes about them on page 400 in the book Acts of the Apostles. It says, in their anxiety, or I should go back a little further, I think, some of the leading brethren of Jerusalem, clinging to former prejudices and habits of thought, had not cooperated heartily with Paul and his associates. So what was striving for the mastery? Old habits of thought, old habits of behavior. In their anxiety to preserve a few meaningless forms and ceremonies, they had lost sight of the blessing that would come to them and to the cause they loved, to an effort to unite in one all parts of the Lord's work. Now, through an effort to unite in one. Now, who is the one in whom they must unite? Jesus Christ. He's the head. And therefore, the only possible true basis for unity was for them to come into line with God's principles of divine order in the Church of God. It goes on to say, although desirous of safeguarding the best interests of the Christian Church. Now, they desire to safeguard the best interests of the Christian Church. Now, what appearance would that desire give to them? What appearance? Would they look like being genuine, concerned Christians? Absolutely. Will they look like being the most responsible and dependable men in the church? Absolutely. Will they look like being godly men? Absolutely. And this, of course, makes the test that much harder for people to bear. And we have to look beyond the sincerity of a person, his genuineness, his good behavior, to the real nature of the mission. That is the test. What is the message that man is supporting? That's the real test. Not what his good behavior might lead you to think about him instead. So they were, although desirous of safeguarding the best interests of the Christian church, they had failed to keep step with the advancing providences of God, and in their human wisdom, in their what kind of wisdom? Human wisdom, attempted to throw about workers some many unnecessary restrictions. Thus there arose a group of men who were unacquainted personally with the changing circumstances and peculiar needs met by labourers in distant fields. And note this next bit, yet who insisted that they had the authority to direct their brethren in these fields to follow certain specified methods of labour. They felt as if the work of preaching the gospel should be carried forward in harmony with their opinions. Now this is natural. We're not to be surprised about this because that's what they came from. And old habits strive for the mastery. Now the situation was not so critical in our movement, but the same pattern was there. We all came out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We'd only known one kind of church organization. We never even questioned that kind of church organization. And we naturally tended to establish the same thing in our midst back in the early 60s. Now then, God in his great love would not let this situation pass without doing something to correct it. And as we know, there shortly came the great council at Jerusalem when James was the chairman apparently. Peter and Paul were present, and the scripture says there was much disputing. And much disputing, of course, is indicative of men trying to force their ideas against the ideas being forced by other men. So it's a face-to-face contention between human ideas, differing human ideas. And the situation was turned about by Peter standing up and saying, in effect, men and brethren, he says, what is all the argument about? The Holy Spirit has already spoken on this subject. He's made his declaration by pouring his Spirit upon the Gentile believers as much as upon the Jewish believers. And the Spirit makes the distinction. So why do we make a distinction? And all you've got to do, Peter said, is to accept the voice of God and do what he says. And that was so logical, so obviously true, that everybody there, apparently the very last person, accepted the counsel given by Peter, and men were turned from their ideas to listen to the voice of God, let him be the plan maker. When they obeyed the voice of God, unity came in amongst those people. Now, this had a double blessing. First of all, it united the church, but secondly, it opened the eyes of this ruling class to see that they had been making a bad mistake. As I read now on page 401, although those present at this meeting was, among those present at this meeting were some who had severely criticized the methods of labor followed by the apostles, upon whom rested the chief burden of carrying the gospel to the Gentile world. But during the council, their views of God's purpose had broadened, and they had united with their brethren in making wise decisions which made possible the unification of the entire body of believers. They made wise decisions which made possible the unification of the entire body of believers. Now, what's the only type of decision which will unify the believers under these circumstances? The decision to step out of the position of being a head or a subhead or any kind of head and give that position back to Jesus Christ. How else could they make decisions that would unify the believers? They couldn't. So then, this corresponds to our 1966 event in Australia when we recognised that we were stepping into God's place by introducing the voting system, or having introduced it, and we made the wise decision to step out of that position and give back to God the headship of the movement. It was an exact counterpart, the same kind of development. Remember, of course, Sister Wise says that in Great Controversy, page 343, that there was a striking similarity between every great religious movement, and God's dealings with men are ever the same, and so on. And the movements of the present have their parallel in those of the past. Well, here's another very, very striking parallel that is very important to us to understand today. Now, the result of this move was great prosperity in the Church of God, and so it was in our movement too. Doors opened in every direction, and the movement began to go forward very strongly. As Sister White says, afterward, When it became apparent that the converts among the Gentiles were increasing rapidly, there were a few of the leading brethren of Jerusalem who began to cherish anew their former prejudices against the methods of Paul and his associates. Right, so now we find a sad reversion. Here was this great council in Jerusalem which changed the whole structure of the church's organization and introduced great prosperity. But then afterwards came this reversion, and when it did, there were a few of the brethren began to cherish anew their former prejudices against the ministry of the Apostle Paul. And these prejudices became so strong that the following developments took place. I'll read them now. These prejudices strengthened with the passing of the years, until some of the leaders determined that the work of preaching the gospel must henceforth be conducted in accordance with their own ideas. If Paul would conform his methods to certain policy which they advocated, they would acknowledge and sustain his work. Otherwise, they could no longer look upon with favour or grant it their support. Now, they'd gone back until they were as bad as the church from which they had come, just as bad. And there's no excuse for this whatsoever. In fact, if they'd been careful, thoughtful, truly responsible men, they would have said, now, all right, back there in Jerusalem, the Holy Spirit spoke to us, we obeyed his voice, and the result of that obedience was prosperity for the church. Now, above all else, we want a prosperous church. So therefore, if that procedure brought prosperity, let's stick to the procedure. But there was a factor which you must not overlook. The prosperity of the church was now threatened by persecution. The preaching of Paul, in that he was calling upon the abandonment of the sacrificial system, the ceremonial system, was threatening to generate tremendous anger in the hearts of the Pharisees, who were fanatically devoted to that sacrificial system, and the church, of course, was threatened with persecution. And those leaders in Jerusalem became more concerned about what they feared would happen to the church, more concerned about results and consequences, they were about obeying God. Instead of confining themselves to two questions, what is God's command and what are his promises, they began to explore the question, what are the consequences of what Paul is doing? And as surely as the consequences were not very attractive, they felt that they had to take over the work of God and do something to remove those consequences. That is, to minimize the prospect of persecution. What they should have said simply was this: Paul is a member, such as we are. He is answerable only to the head, Jesus Christ. He is not answerable to us. His head, Jesus Christ, has appointed him a work to do, a powerful message of preaching to the Gentile world and calling upon men to give up the old ceremonial system. If that's what God has given Paul to do, we don't care what the consequences may be, Paul must do what God has given him to do, and we must lead him to do it. And our responsibility, of course, is by our prayers and by our financial support to ensure that he is unhindered and totally supported in that work. If they'd taken that attitude, they would have maintained the lesson which they'd been taught away back here, but they showed they'd forgotten the lesson. Now, that's tragic, and may it never be written of us that we've forgotten one lesson God has taught us. May there never be any backtracking on our part, as there was on the part of these religious leaders back there in Jerusalem. Now, exactly as those men reverted back to where they'd come from, so Charlie Morgan and the four other people who stood with him, and he had four supporters, Glacina Ferguson, Jack Sleeman, his own wife, and a woman named Mrs. Woolrich. They had reverted right back to where they'd come from, and they showed that they needed to learn the lesson all over again, or if they wouldn't learn the lesson all over again, to suffer separation from God's people. Now then, just as a confrontation was coming up in Paul's day, so a confrontation was coming up in our day back in 1974. It could have been 75. Now, when Paul arrived in Jerusalem, as you read in Acts the 23rd chapter, the brethren, with their minds preoccupied with this persecution problem, this persecution threat, and humanly seeking for a human solution to the problem, and desperately determined to preserve the safety and security of the church, said to Paul, "We have this problem, now to solve it, do this that we say unto you." What significant words they were on their part. That's the exact words in Scripture in Acts the 23rd chapter. "Do this that we say unto you." That's the worst thing they could have said, isn't it? The very worst thing. They should have said, "Paul, you must do what God tells you to do. Nothing else but that." But they said, "No, do what we say unto you. Now, why did Paul do it? Because, as Sister White says, he was terribly burdened. He was terribly frustrated and concerned by the disunity that there was in the church. He longed to be one with his brethren. He hated this division which was there. And he loved and respected those leaders in Jerusalem and longed indeed to come into harmony with them. So he thought, maybe if I just make a little concession, maybe if I just demonstrate to these fellows I'm not stubborn and difficult, maybe they'll come the other half of the road and join with me. They weren't prepared to come at all. Now, I've made the point before that the procedure by which Peter and the other apostles selected Matthias to take the place of the dead Judas was an affront to God. And Matthias, in no sense of the word, was the 12th apostle to take the place of Judas. That Paul was that man. But God's selection of Paul in the face of their selection of Matthias was something which must have been a stinging rebuke to those apostles and church leaders. And the fact that Paul never seemed to have full recognition by the church probably stems from the way in which they went ahead and chose a man of their own choosing instead of the man of God's choosing. What they ought to have done, of course, was to... They should never have appointed Matthias. They should have remembered how that Christ had called 11 of them, and those 11 had been faithful despite their fearful temptation. They had called one of them. The one whom they had called had gone bad, had betrayed their Lord in the most disgraceful and shocking manner, and surely they ought to have learnt their lesson once and for all time, but they exhibited that common human frailty of not learning the lesson on a permanent basis. I think of how many times God came to Israel and tried to teach them the same lesson over and over and over again. They just wouldn't learn. They just wouldn't learn. We have to learn the first time round. No second and third time, but the first time round. And they should have simply said, well, we'll just wait until God appoints a replacement for Judas. That's his business, not ours. And left it at that. But when they went ahead and appointed their own nominee for the position and put him in that position where God had never recognized him, then when God brought his man along, Paul had difficulty throughout the rest of his life being recognized by the church. So all these problems go right back to failures on the church to walk with God from the very first instance. And so Paul made the mistake then of acceding, of bending, of taking a step in their direction, of letting them take the place of God over him. And when Paul did that, when he bent to human pressure, what was the consequence? He lost his freedom. The church was deprived of its champion for the mystery of God. The champions of the mystery of iniquity were then left in control of the church, and the inevitable consequence was the building of the Dark Ages. Millions of precious souls dying in ignorance and despair when the church of God ought already to have been in the kingdom of heaven. Now, as I rode that plane down to Sydney and read this chapter, and all this, and I saw with the sharpest clarity that we were reliving that history, and the same pressure had been brought to me has been brought upon Paul. I knew what I had to do. I had no doubts about it. I knew that even if the entire church forsook the truth of God and left me standing completely alone, I must not under any circumstances obey the voice of men who said to me, "Do this that we say unto you." That Christ alone must remain at my head, and I must calmly but firmly stand for that principle no matter what the cost may be. And I did. And the outcome was incredible, as I shall tell you in the next study period, as this one now is altogether gone. I will say in closing, though, that as I approached the conference, which we'll talk about in the next study period, I approached it absolutely convinced that Charlie Morgan had all the believers by the ears. He had their loyalty, that they're going to come, and that there would be a resounding acclamation for his principles, and my work had come to its end. I was quite convinced about that, but nonetheless, I determined not to yield, and I would quietly present the position, and the believers could make up their minds without any pressure from me whatsoever. It was really living out the Sabbath rest principles in the strongest possible way, and the victory which was gained surprised me and still surprises me, but I'm very, very grateful for it. And that was the greatest crisis this church ever faced, and I'm glad to say that we did come out very much on the right side of it. As I went around the world and reported to the believers in every land, the principles, they were received very, very well, and the church has been operating by those principles ever since. And since that time, the greatest and most wonderful revelation of truth have come to us, the Sabbath rest, God's character, and so on, and the church has grown to its largest and most vigorous proportions. My time is gone, so I'll stop at that point, and we'll pick up this theme again when we meet again at 15 minutes past 11. Now, a suggestion has been made this morning that you might like to give ear to and perhaps join in with. There's an extremely beautiful park just up the road here. Some of you have already been there. And the suggestion is that we carry our lunch up there and enjoy it together in that beautiful area. I didn't think it up. I'll give the credit to somebody else. But I like the idea. So if you'd like to do that, we'll slip along there after the second study period is over and have a nice lunch together in God's great out of doors.